everyone, and welcome to this episode of the video podcast for Security Magazine. I'm your host, Ian Thornton-Trump, and I am now joined by Philip Ingram, who will be co-chairing today, and we have a special guest, Joe Reedon from Sygax. Now, the reason Joe is the special guest is he delved deeply into a Russian cybercrime organization called TrickBot and put out kind of a groundbreaking report on it. So, Joe, to start us off, give us some context. Who is TrickBot?
So, in early March, we saw this Twitter account appear called the TrickBot Leaks, and they started to leak a significant amount of information about this Russian cybercrime group, both in the form of these PDFs, which contained, like, personal information or like a doxing style, and then more internal communications between the group. Now, personally, I sort of thought, well, this needs to be looked into, and so I started to collate this information to a total of nearly a quarter of a million messages and 27 of these PDFs which contain the information. And so it spanned almost a three-year time period of information, and it just, and as you say, began sort of a research into what was contained within them.
Perfect. We're going to get into the specifics, but Philip, longtime expert on Russia and like all things Russia, all things hostile to the United Kingdom, give us some context then on Russians, cybercrime, and the government's hands in it.
Well, it's fascinating. Cybercrime in Russia and a number of other countries around the world is a business. It's run like a business. Unlike all other businesses, especially with the sorts of income that they can generate in Russia, they are controlled by people in power. And those people in power have got direct links into the government. And when you've got an organization that has got the sorts of capabilities of some of the organized crime groups that are operating out of Russia, and the reach that they've got, the Russian government will have very close oversight over everything that they do, and control over a lot of what they do, for two reasons. They'll want to use them as a plausibly deniable arm, and two, they'll want to rake off some of the money in a tax or whatever to help fund their bases. And the interesting thing about the cybercrime bit is the cybercrime groups may be based in Russia where they can hide from international law. But members of the groups will be in different countries around the world who don't see that affiliation into the government, but they do see an affiliation into this group, and they can make some money by being associated with the group. So it gives that international reach, which again gives a real impetus behind Russian government control. And the two organizations that influence into these cybercrime groups are really the FSB, which is the Russian's internal security bureau, but also you get arms of the GRU, the First Directorate, the military intelligence that carry out active operations overseas. They're the organization that carried out the attack on Sergei Skripal in Salisbury. But it's the FSB with some of the GRU that are carrying a lot of the operations into Ukraine at the moment.
I think that really corresponds, and I did read an article that tried to paint the suggestion that cybercrime in Russia is separated from the actual government itself. And I thought it was preposterous because we know as a result of the Georgian attacks that was sort of subcontracted to Russian cybercriminals to carry out. And Russian cybercriminals were involved in the Estonian attacks, which really sort of kicked off the whole thing. So to suggest that all of a sudden they aren't involved at all would be, I think, a little bit of a fringe look.
I describe that as naive, because nothing in Russia is devolved from government control. And you've got something that's as powerful as some of these groups, including the Conti group, as a perfect example. The power that they've got is so big, the damage that they could cause internally, never mind what they can do externally, and the revenue that they can generate is so large that the oligarchs, and certain oligarchs will have control. Those oligarchs are directly linked into the political side of things. But because of the power of these groups and the potential for causing internal damage, and the fact that they're committing international crime, and therefore the government's going to want to have a degree of oversight to know what they're covering up actively, there will be very close government control over what's happening. And if not government involvement, and individuals within the organizations taking an active role in what they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. So Egregor, we all remember the takedown with the Europol and the pictures coming out. You know, we saw folks in their bathrobes and tracksuits and all sorts of beige boxes all over the place. Didn't look like a sophisticated operation. And this is where Joe's insight into sort of cybercrime 2.0 in the TrickBot leaks. Tell us tease us a little bit with some of the interesting findings about how organized these guys were.
Yeah, so the key point that stood out to me was, like, as you say, when looking at these previous things, we've seen, you know, more floppy drives than USB drives in a lot of these computers, and we thought, you know, well, you know, it's a group of, as the stereotype goes, group of hackers in the basement wearing hoodies. And as I started to dig through this stuff, that couldn't have been more false. I started to see more and more implications of, you know, large scales of infrastructure and the ability to spin up, you know, hundreds of servers for doing testing and development and real teams forming within them, you know, with clearly defined teams in for development of different types of malware, different types of obfuscation techniques, and also, you know, things like OSINT and research through the team. And slowly it became quite apparent that this isn't just, like you say, five people just, you know, having a play around and, oh, they've hacked someone. No, it's actually quite a serious operation with serious sort of business objectives, both financially and actually, like you say, potentially politically.
I want to go back to that one point because you mentioned a word, OSINT, open source intelligence. There was another article, and it seems like I'm just attaching plastic explosives to people that are writing these days, but there's another article that suggested that, you know, ransomware was a random thing and, you know, and no, this report categorically shows that the cyber folks working in a cybercrime organization were researching targets, were probing infrastructure in order to put together or use the perfect tool for that attack. Phil, you have any ideas, do you think, around the fact that there is a lot of, like, targeted attack going on as opposed to, like, you know, random phishing emails that are going out?
Huge amount of targeted attacks going on. You just have to go back to the 2017 hacks, and here's where I get both of them mixed up. It was the NotPetya attack, which was using a specific piece of accountancy software targeted at Ukrainian businesses that were mandated by the Ukrainian government to do your tax returns on. And that's where the malware was injected into Ukrainian businesses to close Ukrainian businesses down. It then escaped to the wild. Oops.
Yeah.
As happened. So that, you know, that was targeted. There's a lot of research goes on in it. And there's two elements to the business. There's the highly targeted, highly researched, and highly focused bit. And the more focused it is, the higher priority target that they're going for, and all the rest of it, the more I would say there's probably government involvement in everything else. And then at the other end, there's the money-making bits and everything else, which is, you know, ransomware as a service.
Yeah.
You could argue whether that's targeted or not. It's targeted by the customer. The customer says, can you attack this target for me? Or deliberate denial of service as a service, can you attack this site for me?
So the interesting thing about the TrickBot leaks was really, these folks weren't just conducting the attacks, they were building the infrastructure and the coding along with some client relationships that you've discovered in the report. Tell us about sort of that effort that they're making.
Yeah, so there was, obviously, like you say, there was these actual development teams, and that, you know, people were having dedicated projects with project names and project sort of specifications. And we saw through the Conti leaks, which again were a few weeks prior, which sort of, again, happened all around the same time. We had a very, lots of actual documents as well, like personal internal documents of training documents were all leaked alongside that as well. And inside of that were some that kind of, I think, got sometimes glossed over, with these almost project specifications and, like, they called them terms of reference, I think was the internal term. And these large documents of thousands of words of just, like, perfectly detailing projects. And then, like I say, inside the report I found one link between, it was referred to internally as the Crypto Locker Project. And I understand that is a generic term sometimes used, but then you look inside the context and there was the Crypto Locker terms of reference. And I'm like, okay. And then you start to look between the messages and the reference, and actually there's a lot of similarities. And so these development teams are, as you say, really quite sort of well developed and are working sort of together to build these tools. And so you have groups as well where every single member of this group is working on a different tool, and they specify that. They say, we're not working together on these things, we want to build as much potential sort of IP almost as much as we can, but we're all going to work together to help work through these issues and make it as quickly and as sort of efficient process as possible.
What I found really fascinating about the report is it showed that there is a cozy relationship between the Zeus banking Trojan, or the person known as Zeus, and the TrickBot organization. So one crew focused on ransomware. Obviously, the Zeus Trojan is more involved in banking, compromising bank accounts. You want to tell us a little bit about that crossover?
Of course. So again, I was through a bit of just sort of a couple of names popping up and trying to pull out some of the key sort of names that kept appearing. And there was one name of this Zeus that kept popping up. And I say, as the inquiry was, like, I looked at it, it was weird. It sort of had multiple contexts. Sometimes it was like, oh, the person Zeus. And so I was referring to, like, as a software and, like, how it has, like, sort of configurations. Like, well, you know, that doesn't make sense. And then actually sometimes, like, as a collective, as a group. And so through looking at it, we sort of found that there was actually the terms, like you say, like client and sort of partners were being used. And, again, obviously a lot of this was translated from Russian, but it was coming up too regularly to be sort of a poor translation, so to speak. And so, like you say, there was almost this client relationship between these groups, because I think the relationship is a mutually beneficial one between the groups. You know, they're a TrickBot being a really highly tooled, they've got lots of infrastructure in use, also having their own sort of tooling infrastructure, but together they can help build that common goal and that common aim to try and cause disruption and potentially, like you say, financial gain as well.
Yeah. See, this is fascinating when you look at those different groups and bits and pieces, because we look at the news today and we're beginning of August. There's talk of Vladimir Putin reaching out to North Korea to get support and North Korean troops and equipment to help him in Ukraine. Shows how desperate he is. But there are two internet pipelines into North Korea. One, which is relatively low bandwidth, comes in from China, has been there forever. The other, a high bandwidth pipeline that comes in from Russia, was provided 4 or 5 years ago by the Russian National Railway Company. And therefore, Russia controls everything that goes in and out. And your talk of the financially focused groups that are in there and the crypto locker groups that are in there and the target on that, there's no way can North Korea generate all of its own expertise whenever its people don't have access to the internet and they don't have technical universities with all of that. They'll get a lot of it delivered into them where it can be used as plausibly deniable, from a plausibly deniable perspective, and their primary target is crypto and getting wealth from elsewhere and hitting the banking. And therefore, the other thing that a lot of these criminal groups do is they will develop and beta test and deliver tools out to other groups so that they can do the tasks that they want to do across the globe. So whether it's attacking critical national infrastructure, whether it's attacking banking, whether it's targeting crypto, you know, they've got customers that they will supply tools to. And that's a big part of how they make their business, because they'll always take a slice of what it is that they're making for their customers.
Okay, of course, that's how it works.
I think the key thing on that is actually that you say we have this almost shared security in the sort of, you know, the good sense of trying to help each other and the releasing of DTPs and IOCs to try and help build the community. But I think it's almost naive to say that isn't happening on the other side as well. Yeah. And this sort of building of a community to help each other, because they're all probably experiencing very similar issues in the way, like you say, with, you know, crypto, especially now as a target for North Korea. It wouldn't be surprising to see that, oh, well, we've found this new thing here, why don't we help these guys out? Because it's a mutually beneficial relationship to build between these groups to sort of, as you say, build almost strong crime community almost.
Yeah. Well, and this is the other thing that people need to realize. You know, it's very easy to turn around and say serious organized crime and organized crime groups and all the rest of it, and you dismiss it as a bunch of, you know, thugs running around with swag bags over their shoulders and everything else. You talked of the detail of the plans, you talked of the detail of the specification of the requirements and everything else. These are businesses. They're run as businesses. They're run better than most other international corporations because the stakes are higher. The only difference is what they're doing is internationally illegal, but they're but they're based in Russia because they know that provided they keep paying their taxes to the government, like any business would do, they're going to be protected. And that's why they keep going.
It's fascinating to me because in a couple of ways, The ransomware crews have been doing really, really well. The attempts by Russian cyber forces to, you know, attack the Ukrainian national critical infrastructure, other than a little bit of initial success with the disruption of the satellites, have all failed miserably. So I find it fascinating that it seems maybe the Russians were a bit of a paper bear, to use the term, in terms of their cyber forces within that context. But having said that, the real disruption event and the real thing that happened in terms of like people leaking information about Conti and about TrickBot was the war.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Phil, why don't you kind of walk us through a little bit about what the cyber war piece looked like, you know, and how maybe that was beneficial or disruptive to cyber criminals?
Well, the cyber war, when it comes to looking at Ukraine, a lot of cyber professionals have been very surprised that it hasn't been more front and center of everything that's going on. The reality is, it has been, but it's not the main effort for what's going on in the conflict. There are cyber attacks happening on a daily basis, whether they be deliberate denial of service, whether they be other methods of trying to shut different capabilities down, whether it be cyber espionage to try and get ahead of where the Ukrainians are going, or targeting the countries that are supplying weapon systems and training of personnel into Ukraine, as well as targeting Ukraine's critical national infrastructure to try and continue in a cyber environment the attack on the center of population to try and break the will of the people and break the will of the politicians. However, it's being rebuffed. Why is it being rebuffed? Well, Ukraine has been suffering this since the first invasion in Crimea,
yep,
in 2014, but actually a lot longer than that.
Yep.
Putin started his information operations against Ukraine in about 2003.
Yep.
And we have to bring the information domain into this. So Ukraine has been under active cyber attack since about 2003 from Russia, and therefore they've had all of that time to build up their defences. Not only have they had all of that time to build up their defences by themselves, but they've also had the cooperation of the international community, in particular UK, US and European nations, and ensuring they can provide all of the cyber defence tools that they need. The quid pro quo is that we get all the intelligence back from what the Russians are trying to do. But it shows that our defences are pretty good and we are keeping the Russians at bay. The other bit is, when it comes to war, this is a shooting war, and it's a shooting war with very old equipment, and cyber doesn't affect a 152mm high explosive shell or a 40-year-old Flogger aircraft dropping dumb bombs or 7.62mm short round, and therefore it can have no immediate impact on the battlefield. But cyber is ongoing continuously. It's just not having that wider impact. And the Russians are also scared. They're scared of doing something like the NotPetya and it escaping out into the wild, and that then stimulating NATO to come in even harder. Remember, the Secretary of NATO has said that under certain circumstances, a cyber attack could be construed as an Article 5 incident. And Vladimir Putin doesn't want that, because he knows that from a cyber perspective, from a national side of things, in a cyber perspective, he is much more vulnerable than the West is. He will try and avoid that as much as he can.
I think that's a great summary, because, Joe, you saw this play out within the TrickBot organization when it was suggested that they would throw in on the side of Russia. And I think we have forgotten that prior to the war in Ukraine, there were plenty of Ukrainian cyber criminals going to work in there, because the security services and the relationship, there was some looking the other way going on in Ukraine. You want to talk a little bit about the internal politics and mess that kicked off?
Yeah, I think that's the key point you brought in about people like coming in and working for them. And I think it's often forgotten that it is a job. As we've said, it's a business. Yeah. It's the same thing as a job. And when we're looking at the fact that they have salaries, and you've got a paid salary, you're paid twice a month, you're paid on average, you're starting at around £2,000 a month, or $2,000 a month, sorry, being paid straight in Bitcoin, you have... It's actually quite a secure straight in, and they are often operating around these, they're using the forums and stuff like that we've seen in, within the leaks. One example of them using the forums as an employment tool,
mm-hmm.
and saying, okay, oh, are you from carding? Are you from, you know, a bit of exploitation? What are you here for? We like the look of you. Oh, we want you to become one of our OSINT leads.
Mm-hmm.
And now that, as an employment tool, is incredible. It's building those sort of the people who are, you know, low-level, probably committing low-level crime, nothing serious, and suddenly bringing them into this new world. And from that example alone, the person who was brought in hadn't even heard of the TrickBot group before.
Yeah.
And he's asked, you know, just Google it, you'll find out, which is, I still think, a genius quote. And so it's like, I think it's that sort of employment like level, and you're saying you have these sort of managers whose jobs are dedicated to finding these teams of people. And I think the key thing is actually they want to find the best people for the job. It isn't just like the, you know, the sort of the, you know, like, oh, well, you haven't got, oh, come on, we'll teach you how to do so. Actually, I think some of these people are the, some of the industry, almost industry experts in this area, you know, in malware development and levels like that, that can really help push the group, and they're going to pay for that.
Some of them even had day jobs.
Yeah.
Right? And so this was like their second kind of job on top of the jobs.
Yeah.
I found it fascinating within the report, though, that you specifically looked at some of the leadership figures, and some of them have disappeared.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. So the management structure, like you say, is quite a wide-reaching thing. Again, and something I wouldn't have thought, but you look at it and you realize, okay, there's like 3, 4, or 5 names that keep popping up. And actually, with not only large numbers of communication, with, you know, 10,000 in one sort of chain over a period of, you know, 2 years or so, but actually it's also looking at what they're talking about. And, you know, yes, it's not just like, oh, you know, we're developing, oh, I don't know, the, you know, sending across Stack Overflow links, which there are enough of, but it's also things, you know, like how are we paying, what are we, where are we procuring people? And like you say, there was a couple of people in that top level management, sort of the top level management, who towards the end, it appeared through some message that we saw, actually did end up go missing and sort of actually fell out of the, for whatever reason. There was an interesting message in one of the group chats where he states, you know, that I don't, I can't sort of drag you along anymore, but the chief has gone. And quite frankly, he points out this is quite a dire situation. We're running out of money, and we can barely pay the salaries for this month.
Well, see, this is interesting because it's a crime group. It may be based in Russia, but it's got its tentacles out elsewhere. And one of the closest set of tentacles was into Ukraine, into the cyber criminal groups inside Ukraine. And they will, you know, there'll have been two elements to that. There'll have been loyal Ukrainians who will have seen it as making money and, you know, don't support the Russian state and will forget that this is linked to the Russian state, but they see money that coming in. And then there'll be Russian sympathizing Ukrainians that come in. And you'll find it in, you know, the other old Soviet states, but also other countries around the world. And as soon as the war in Ukraine came in and people started to look at the implications of that, and also started to look at how other intelligence services from across the world were then looking at who was interacting with all of these things. Some of the disappearances will have been individuals going, you know, morally, actually, I'm Ukrainian. Now that Russia's done this, I cannot have any association with it. So they'll have cut the ties. The others on the Russian side will say, Russian side of Ukraine will have said, well, yes, I could keep doing that, but actually I've now been called up and I have to go to fight in the front. And then there's others around the world that will have had the tap on the shoulder from different intelligence agencies going, we know what you're up to and this isn't very good at the moment, so please either come and work for us, which is what I do, or you know, stop what you're doing and stop it instantly, otherwise we're going to expose you. And that's what will be happening, and it will hurt them from a business perspective because they probably won't have done this as a contingency plan, and that will have affected what their outputs are, which could be one of the reasons why this leak has suddenly appeared.
And I think that was the key point about that contingency plan. In a normal business, like you say, you've got your, you know, your bus factor, you know, how many people can we lose before this falls over? But I think in crime, that isn't thought about as much, and I think it may come from that inherent distrust of, you know, there's one person who can access all the money, because if we have too many people, you know, what if someone tries to, you know, pull it all in? And I think there is that inherent distrust, but what that means is, like you say, if one of the leadership goes, it can, you know, you're building your house on sand, it's all going to crumble.
I think it's from a law enforcement tactic, and I know our head of operations been 20 plus years actively looking at cybercrime, and he knew that we were onto something special with this particular research. What I think is really fascinating is this is a case of, if you can identify the head of those organizations, and I say this head because it appeared from your research that this chairman of, you know, TrickBot had other relationships with other groups, like Wizard Spider, for instance, right? And so what we need to do is identify those high-level players in order to be more effective with the law enforcement activity that's out there. And this shows that a targeted attack on the bad guys can be really disruptive. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, struck me was this was a group of maybe, what, 130, 140 people, so a small business making big money.
Yeah.
But ultimately, the head, the senior leadership of those organizations are the ones that need to be held accountable, not, you know, the guy that did the equivalent of sweeping the floor or testing the malware against antivirus.
And again, you said they're paid in Bitcoin. That to international law enforcement is invaluable. And the research that you've done to identify the nodes and everything else will make it much easier for international law enforcement, international intelligence agencies to identify the key players. And as you said, there's only going to be one or two who've got access to the crypto wallets for the business as it's all coming in. And then you can watch where the transactions are coming out of those wallets, and you can track them and, yep, and trace them all over the world. So the international intelligence community, you will love the report that you've done and be sitting there rubbing their hands in glee going, we can find these little scroats wherever they are.
Not enough glee to garner a reward from the Americans, but I would say...
I would suggest that we have to remind you that this will have helped and will be saving you billions.
Because they actually did offer a $10 million reward for information leading to the arrest of TrickBot and associates. So
See, that's the fallout. They said leading to the arrest.
Yeah.
Knowing full well that as they're based in Russia, the Russian Constitution doesn't allow individuals to be arrested. So very careful wording.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Joe, any sort of thoughts, like a few things that we haven't covered today that you'd sort of like people, if I was going to picking up the report, what are some of the key things that you think are really exciting?
We've kind of touched on a lot of them. I think that is the exciting parts really are about that sort of business-like nature that we've sort of uncovered through this, and that I think it allows us as sort of security like professionals to actually look at these threat groups properly and actually look at them through the correct lens. Because if we're trying to defend against them and not looking at them through the correct lens, it's not, you're not going to be doing a great job.
Yeah.
And so I think by actually treating them and giving them the sort of gravitas they deserve as these sort of like actually business-like natures, and the fact that we realize that, you know, you're developing security solutions to try and combat them, well, they're also developing security solutions to try and combat you. And it's that actual head-to-head that I think allows us to sort of look forward and potentially say, right, okay, if we're going to try and combat these groups, we need to actually fight them on their own level, really, rather than sort of, as we've seen multiple times, people underestimating their abilities and then suddenly realizing, oh dear, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think that's the key point, really, is like you say, and I think it's that sort of interconnected nature as well. And I think you brought it up sort of there about the sort of those top guys and how, you know, especially over like the Conti leaks and Triple E's, how names were popping up across them. And, you know, you're seeing these names and actually in the high levels being, and you're like, okay, wait, there's management across these. And I think it's important to recognize there clearly are some real key people in the sort of crime industry, especially in cybercrime, and actually that they are a lot wider encompassing and working over a lot broader base than I think we often perceive.
One sort of last thing, and this is sort of for Phil and you as well to think about. So Costa Rica, in the headlines for getting viciously cyber attacked by Conti, or allegedly Conti, and a country. Mm. Are cyber criminals at the high end of APT-like, are they now a nation-state threat? What are your thoughts?
Oh, 100% they're a nation-state threat, especially when they've got the backing of nation-states. And looking at it, the resources that they've got, and this is what I was going to say on your comments, they probably have more resources that they can focus on developing the attack tools than many of the nation-state organizations have to defend, because they're controlled by government budgets and everything else.
And they have to do PDRs for everyone.
Exactly. These organizations are not controlled by that. They're controlled by the market forces, and they can throw a lot more resources and buy in a lot more help from across the globe than what we're getting in. So that's where that comes from. The question that I have in the very early bit of your research is, one of the things that the Russians are very good at is putting out disinformation. What made you think, as you started to see the leak, that this was genuine and not you trying to be spoofed at the beginning?
So there was that was one of the first considerations. You look at this and it's like, it's a massive amount of data, but who's actually verified? Because there is no way to verify this. But I think the key things that did verify it were actually simultaneously the sheer amount of information,
yeah,
because we're looking at, as say, 250,000 messages inside of this thing over a period of 3 years with continued themes. And for someone to almost fake that, I think, is almost more work than it is. And I think, especially as also considering looking at the other leaks we've seen, and I think the Conti leaks got quite unanimously sort of respected, and I think there is a decent, yeah, number of people, I personally believe there is a decent amount of verification behind that. However, I think it was the ties across. And you, yep, say, okay, well, they're talking about that there, but they're also talking about that in Conti leaks. And I think it was a very much sort of, from the disinformation perspective, it felt as I went through it, initially, like you say, of course, you're like, well, how do I know that's that? I don't know. And obviously there's no way to actually verify every single piece of information. But it becomes to a point where you're like, there's too much here for it all to be incorrect. And I think there is elements that may be within that data that either never, like you say, a project that never came to fruition, which it could be seen as some sort of disinformation. But so much of it had such a through line and so much effort behind it, and that it felt like, and it felt like real people having real conversations in a real work environment, which I think is quite hard to sort of fake in that sense.
Yeah, and the very fact that you've gone through a process of considering that the whole way through it and from the very outset adds an extra level of credence to the fantastic work that you've done.
We do have some insight though on who the leaker might be. And this is really interesting because way before this leak appeared, there was a US Cybercom operation to disrupt TrickBot because they were becoming extraordinarily dangerous about 2 or 3 years ago, I think it was. It's possible that it wasn't just disruption, it was infiltration and exfiltration of this data. The real question would be is what would the security forces of the United States, why would they suddenly make it public at this relatively the same time the Conti leaks went? So the context of that, of what sort of happened in cybercrime, usually if you have infiltrated an enemy organization, you would keep that as a highly classified thing.
Yeah, but there's two ways of infiltrating, and everyone thinks of you going in electronically and stealing the stuff electronically and getting it out through some form of untraceable backdoor or whatever.
Well, yes, because that's how the cyber operations work.
Well,
right?
Yeah, but the other way is the approach that I take is you hack someone who's got access and you have them as an agent working for you, and they exfiltrate the data, and then one of those disappeared who still has that access because the company's so big they haven't revoked their access to everything, gets it out there. So it would suggest potentially senior management, and that's where the intelligence agencies that are running the human sources would have been rubbing their hands in glee.
Absolutely.
I think the one thing to build on that was actually like when we looked at the Conti leaks, and personally when it first leaked and I was like, wow, there's a lot of information here. Looking through that as I did, there were lots of there was a few messages I can remember of actually people within the group being like, "This, I'm not happy with what Russia's doing, I'm not happy with this sort of stance," as we've said previously. And I initially thought, oh wow, this must be a insider threat. And I thought, okay, well, we'll have to look at what insider threat within crime. There's a new way of looking at it. Yeah.
But an insider threat.
Yes, and obviously when it suddenly came to light that it was a Ukrainian security researcher, as I think it did in the end, with his article he wrote, I was like, okay, right, so it was an insider threat, but it was at point, and I think it's important to note that it wouldn't be surprising if we saw this potential insider threat even within these groups that I don't think they would have thought about so much, because so much of an external look that I don't know how much you'd look internally as well on that.
Yeah, well, a very good friend of mine was an Al-Qaeda for 10 years. He just happened to work for us for most of the time that he was there. So that shows how you can get the insider. And these groups will be targeted, not just electronically, but by human intelligence as well, through the CIA, MI6, and all of the other human intelligence agencies that are out there, because it's almost a better way of getting access to them.
Yeah, it makes sense. Well, I think on that note, we'll close it down. Thank you so much, Joe, for first of all, writing the excellent report, but also for sharing your thoughts on it today. And of course, Philip Ingram, it's always great to see you, and I'm just absolutely delighted. So thank you very much to Security Magazine, and we'll see you next month.